Well, good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. I'm Annie Johnson, a member of your board. Sunday is that day we gather together to deepen our spirituality and support each other in our free and responsible search for truth and meaning in our lives. If you are a visitor, we're delighted you are here. If you're interested in receiving further information, please fill out a blue visitor's card that can be found on the tables at the back of the sanctuary and around the corner here, just outside of the sanctuary here. After service, please join us downstairs for coffee and conversation. We would love to get to know you. Whatever your faith, whatever your heritage, today you are part of our spiritual community. We keep up to date with church happenings through our newsletter, but each Sunday we generally have a few announcements to either highlight or add to that information. If you have thoughts about something you would like to hear as a sermon topic, please do share it with us. Where's Natalie? Natalie or me or whoever. I don't know who else to say. But anyway, Natalie and I will work. Let's see. If you want to help find speakers or even speak about it, all the better. We are looking for people to join the worship committee still. The worship committee finds speaker topics and speakers and leads our services. Although we would willingly accept someone who wanted to only be a service leader or to only help us find sermon and speakers. So if you're interested in that, please do join us. Upcoming services, February 25th, Black History Month, Reverend Jenny Barrington guest preaching. In honor of Black History Month, this service will explore the Harlem Renaissance and the works of Langston Hughes. That sounds good to me. March 3rd will be our Stewardship Sunday. Our annual meeting is coming up at the end of April. And so we're getting ourselves set up to do a new budget for next year and all that good stuff. March 10th will be Second Sunday, exploring Article 2. This is Session 2, led by Natalie Brake. And March 18th will be appellate criminal law attorney Lisa Johnson speaking on Indiana criminal law, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you have particular aspects of the law you would like to hear about, please let me know, and I will forward to Lisa since she's my spouse. I would also remind you that 9 a.m. each Sunday morning, some of us meet for the Breakfast Club, where we share an open discussion and donuts, or occasionally topics. We just started talking today about the book, The Hero Within, which is about archetypes. That's a very interesting discussion today, I think. Are there any announcements from the floor? Jeff?
I'm Jeff, I'm the treasurer, and like Mary said, the pledge drive is going to start up real soon, like this week. Get those in, and do we include a guide from UUA?
Yes, we did. We did. Okay. In the spirit of fellowship and community, please take a moment to greet those around you.
They wouldn't hear your music, and they pulled your paintings down. They wouldn't hear your writing, and they banned you from the town. But they couldn't stop you dreaming, and a victory you have won. For you sowed the seeds of freedom in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons. You sow the seeds of freedom in your daughters and your sons. Your weary smile, it proudly hides the chain marks on your hands. as you bravely strive to realize the rights of every man. And though your body's bent and low, a victory you have won. For you sow the seeds of justice in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons. You sow the seeds of justice in your daughters and your sons. I don't know your religion, but one day I heard you pray for a world where everyone can work and children can play. And though you never got your share of the victories you have won, you sowed the seeds of equality in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons. You sowed the seeds of equality in your daughters and your sons. They taunted you in Belfast, they tortured you in Spain, and in that Warsaw ghetto where they tied you up in chains, in Vietnam and Chile where they came with tanks and guns. It's there you sowed the seeds of peace in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons. You sowed the seeds of real peace in your daughters and your sons. And now your music's playing and the writing's on the wall, and all the dreams you painted can be seen by one and all. Now you got them thinking and a victory's just begun, for you sowed the seeds of freedom in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons. You sowed the seeds of freedom in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons, in your daughters and your sons. You sowed the seeds of freedom in your daughters and your sons.
Thank you, Brenda. This is a quote from Thomas Jefferson as our opening reading. All, too, will bear in mind this sacred principle, that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable, and that the minority possesses their equal rights, which equal law must protect. To violate would be oppression. And I meant to apologize when I started that we don't have an order of service this morning. I wrote it about 11 o'clock last night, and apparently I didn't print it and put it with stuff to bring. So it's been a very busy week. Sheila Kennedy spoke at this church a few years ago about the tension between freedom and community, where community tries to define you, limit who you can be, limiting your freedom. And UU churches, we don't feel that tension, or at least not very much, because UU churches don't try to define you, but only ask you to live as a moral and ethical person, guided by our principles. Our chalice is the container of our community, and our flame shines bright with the light of all our combined moral and ethical actions, which come together to create our community of love, strength, freedom, and help heal the world. Please rise for our affirmation of our covenant, which is not in your order of service because you don't have one. Oh, well. Make believe, yeah. Most of us know what I think. We proudly carry the flame of religious freedom. We respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. This is our covenant. Please remain standing while we sing hymn number 170, We Are a Gentle, Angry People.
Okay.
And I'm sure Bill and Brenda will give you a chance to get your hymnals out here. 170.
170. And we forgot to put the hymn numbers up on the board, and
so
today would have been the day we needed it.
I don't know how many of you know the trickster, but I think he's here today. Coyote. Yeah.
Gentle, angry people, and we are singing for our lives. We are a gentle, angry people, and we are singing for our lives. We are justice-seeking people, and we are singing for our lives. We are a justice-seeking people, and we are singing for our lives.
Contributions to this congregation come from sacrifice and hard work. We are so grateful for this and commit together to ensure the funds that we gather collectively do a greater good for ourselves and our world than they could have done separately. We also offer thanks for all of the gifts of your time and talent that you have given and continue to give. Even your attending church services is a gift, a kindness, in fact, as your attendance helps strengthen our community. And your presence here is a gift to our service leader, our musicians, our board members, our worship committee members, and all of the others who contribute to keeping our church alive and well. For our visitors, please don't give unless you are truly moved to. Know that your presence is gift enough. For those of you who are members or friends, please consider giving through the donation links on our website or the QR code that's not in your order of service today, but is down on the bulletin board at the bottom of the stairs. I lost my place here. Or by placing your donation after the service in one of the silver offering plates on the tables at either end of the sanctuary, here and here. Funds given into the offering plate will go to this month's not-for-profit, which is, help me, Natalie.
Hendricks County Food Pantry Coalition.
Hendricks County Food Pantry Coalition. Funds will go to that not-for-profit. If you wish to donate to the church through the offering plate with a check, please note this on the check. Our musicians will give us offer us a music. Oh, excuse me, Bill will offer us a musical interlude. Thank you, Bill. Our speaker today is Professor Sheila Kennedy. Sheila is Professor Emerita, Law and Public Policy in the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, or is it now?
It's now Indiana University, Indianapolis,
okay. I was having trouble finding a quote to introduce her talk, and so I asked her if she had a recommendation. She did, short and to the point. Where the law ends, there tyranny begins. William Pitt. We will try to save some time for questions at the end. I give you Professor Sheila Kennedy.
Every time I come here, I think maybe I should be a Unitarian.
You don't have to stop being Jewish to be a Unitarian.
But do you have to stop being an atheist? Anyway.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, well, that's helpful.
Those are our favorites.
You know, I talked to Phil Gully the other day, and he said the same thing. Anyway, we live in an era where religion's getting pretty suspect. Okay, the 14th Amendment. Now, thanks to our current political environment, and especially to an argument that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment requires that we bar Donald Trump from the ballot, we've seen a real explosion in references to the 14th Amendment. And I assume that's why I was asked to talk about it. Anyway, but the 14th Amendment has been really incredibly important for a long time, and for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with Section 3. Together with the 13th and 15th Amendments, the 14th is credited with strengthening and actually reframing the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Together, those three amendments are often referred to, at least by legal scholars, as our second founding. You're going to get the equivalent of my class lecture on the 14th Amendment, so I want to apologize in advance. Okay. That's what every student always asks. Anyway, the 13th, as you all know, outlawed slavery, and the 15th Amendment forbid abridging a citizen's right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Together with the 14th, they are called the Reconstruction Amendments. And of the three, obviously the 14th is the lengthiest and therefore the most ambitious. Thanks mainly to the Equal Protection Clause, it's now considered to be part of the Bill of Rights. The first section is the one that we are all most familiar with. It reads, and I'm going to read it to you in its entirety, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And I will just take a little break here and point out that while citizens are protected against the abridgment of privileges and immunities, all persons are being protected against deprivations of life, liberty, or property, and all persons are entitled to the equal protection of the laws. So keep that in mind. Okay. The congressman who drafted the 14th Amendment, back then a Republican, John Bingham, was very clear that his intention was to make the Bill of Rights binding on the states. Most Americans today don't realize that before the passage of the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights only limited actions by the federal government. Bingham insisted that his language, privileges and immunities, encompassed the entire Bill of Rights, and it made them binding on the states. And the contemporaneous arguments that occurred for and against passage tended to focus on that outcome. Nevertheless, the 14th Amendment, after it was passed, the Supreme Court took a number of years and a collection of discrete cases to apply most of the constraints of the Bill of Rights against state and local government actors. The court said they had to find that it was a fundamental liberty, and we haven't had uniformly wonderful Supreme Courts. At any rate, after a lengthy time and a number of cases, the 14th Amendment did affect what Bingham had wanted, which was to make the Bill of Rights, the first eight amendments, binding on the states. And that process was called, for reasons I will never understand, incorporation. I think the reason was to make the students have a problem with the text. Anyway, it is called incorporation. If you're drinking at a cocktail party sometime and you want to sound smart, you'll know that. Okay. Before the passage of the 14th Amendment, state and local officials could establish religions, prevent you from exercising your right to speak freely, they could engage in blatantly discriminatory behaviors and other activities that violated those first eight amendments of the Bill of Rights. An important clause in Section 1 established birthright citizenship, which has recently become something of a flashpoint for the considerable number of racists and self-defined patriots who want to close America's borders and prevent the children of immigrants from becoming American citizens. Since most, if not all, of the people who are arguing against birthright citizenship are not descended from Native Americans, the hypocrisy is kind of notable. The second section of the 14th Amendment is historically interesting, but generally obsolete. It forbids denying the right to vote to any male inhabitant of a state who has reached the age of 21 and is a citizen. And of course, since passage of that language, we've extended the vote to women and lowered the voting age to 18, both of which seem to annoy a lot of men. The third section of the 14th Amendment is the one that has recently become relevant, shall we say, to the current election cycle. It reads, "No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability. Well, the Supreme Court of Colorado, as you probably all know, has concluded that the language of Section 3 that I just read you precludes Donald Trump from appearing on Colorado's ballot. That decision is on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will now have to decide whether to affirm or reject Colorado's analysis, whether Section 3 bars Donald Trump from appearing on all of the nation's presidential ballots. It certainly seems to me straightforward, because in order to evade the clear language of Section 3, the court will have to find that the president isn't an officer of the United States, or that the provision isn't what we lawyers like to call self-executing. That is, that it would require Congress to pass a bill to make it operative. Neither of those arguments really passes the smell test. The court could also find that Trump didn't engage in insurrection, a finding that would be somewhat unpersuasive. Given the justices' performance at the oral argument in this case, I think we can safely assume that they will find a way to duck the clear implications of the constitutional language. Finally, Sections 4 and 5 of the 14th confirm the validity of the national debt and authorize Congress to enforce the provisions of the 14th Amendment by appropriate legislation. You know, the most important operation of the 14th Amendment, at least in my opinion, is that it constitutionalized the Declaration of Independence promise of freedom and equality. Scholars refer to the Reconstruction Amendments as America's second founding because passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments transformed our nation's charter from what was really an aggressively pro-slavery document into one that prohibited chattel slavery. It changed it from a document that was silent on the Declaration's call for equality to one that granted equal citizenship to everyone born on American soil. And it changed the Constitution from a charter that stood aside while state governments abused individual rights to one that protected those rights against state and local government abuses. A constitutional insistence on equal protection of the laws effected a fundamental change in American politics and society. As historian Eric Foner has explained, no state gave black people full legal equality before the Reconstruction era and the 14th Amendment. Supreme Court decisions over the past century, outlawing racial segregation, decreeing one person, one vote, and many others, have rested on the 14th Amendment. Foner and many other historians think that the 14th Amendment should be seen as a form of regime change, an attempt to change the United States from a pro-slavery regime, which is really what we had before the Civil War, to one based on equality, regardless of race. That's a pretty fundamental change. Historian Heather Cox Richardson has written that the 14th Amendment established the power of the federal government to defend civil rights, voting, and government finances from a minority that had entrenched itself in power in the states and from that power base had tried to impose its ideology on the nation. The 14th Amendment prevents government from denying citizens the equal protection of the laws. Now, what constitutes equal protection can be complicated because government needs to classify citizens for all kinds of perfectly acceptable reasons. You know, the law draws distinctions between children and adults, between motorists and pedestrians, between smokers and non-smokers, and enforcing different rules for those groups does not run afoul of the 14th Amendment. What the Equal Protection Doctrine is intended to do is to prevent government from imposing inappropriate classifications, those that are based on criteria that are irrelevant to the subject of the law or that unfairly burden a particular group. The general rule is that a government classification must be rationally related to a legitimate government interest. A requirement that motorists observe a speed limit is clearly a classification related to government's legitimate interest in public safety. A law that imposed different speed limits on African Americans and Caucasian drivers just as clearly would be illegitimate. But of course, it's more complicated than that, because although laws can be discriminatory on their face, I mean, you could have a law saying only white males could vote, these days, laws meant to discriminate are usually crafted to achieve that result by design. That is, they're drawn to look impartial on their face, but to have a discriminatory effect. You know, a rule that all firefighters must weigh over 180 pounds would prevent many more women from being firefighters than men, despite the fact that weight is not an indicator of the ability to handle a fire hose or climb a ladder. There are also situations in which genuinely neutral laws are applied in a discriminatory fashion. Those are harder to get out, but the phrase driving while black grew out of statistics showing that some police officers were disproportionately stopping black motorists for speeding and letting white motorists go by. The courts are going to look more closely at classifications that burden constitutional rights or that disadvantage members of groups that have historically been subject to discrimination. Lawyers call that process of taking a closer look heightened or strict scrutiny. The Equal Protection Doctrine is intended to prevent government from disadvantaging individuals and minorities of whom majorities disapprove. Equal protection guarantees, like all other provisions of the Bill of Rights, apply only against government action. Civil rights statutes address private sector discrimination. Here in Red, Indiana, for example, our civil rights statutes don't forbid discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. So unless you live in a city or town that has a civil rights ordinance with that language in it, private companies in your town can fire people for being gay, and restaurants can refuse to sell pizza to somebody they perceive as gay. Essentially, the Equal Protection Clause requires government to treat its citizens as individuals, not as members of a group. American law is supposed to be based on a person's civic behavior, not gender, race, or other identity. So long as we obey the laws, pay our taxes, and generally conduct ourselves in a way that doesn't endanger or disadvantage others, we're entitled to full civic equality. That guarantee of equal civil rights has unleashed the productivity of previously marginalized groups, and it's contributed significantly to American prosperity. As we're seeing, it's also motivated a considerable backlash from people who see equality for those people as an attack on their rightful social privilege. Critics of equal protection often argue that equality and liberty are at odds, that an individual's liberty includes the right to dislike or disapprove of others, and that true liberty would include the right to act on those negative opinions. What the 14th Amendment responds in essence is, fine, dislike black people or Jews or gays. Don't invite them to dinner. Tell your daughter not to date them. But don't ask government to pass rules that discriminate against them or that prevent them from voting or otherwise participating as equals in the political system or civil society. With that, I conclude this very superficial description of the 14th Amendment, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can answer. I put you all to sleep, didn't I?
Okay, well, back to Article 3. My concern with the current case is who gets to define insurrection. Because my biggest issue with allowing Colorado to make that definition would be the year that Texas decides someone who participated in a Black Lives Matter protest is not qualified to run for president because they were engaged in insurrection. What is the view of that particular argument?
I am going to suggest that it is irrelevant because the court is not going to knock him off the ballot.
Well,
you know, yeah. And but I think that is an absolutely appropriate concern. What's going on in Texas right now is an abomination. Is abomination a religious term? I don't know. Anyway, on any legal grounds, religious grounds, it's an abomination. The other aspect of what you're suggesting is that if the court were to find that Colorado, first of all, if the court were to find that Colorado was doing that and not make a rule that the entire country had to follow, the next thing Texas or Florida would do is knock Biden off the ballot for some reason or other. I mean, we are at a time when people are simply irrational. And much as, you know, I'm one of these old-fashioned believers in the rule of law, but I do think that what has to happen if we're going to save America is that the election has to be left to the voting public, and I can pray that Americans do the right thing. But at any rate, I think the court is making what is essentially a political calculation on this particular case. This particular court has come under a great deal of criticism for a lot of very good reasons, but on this one, I have a sneaking sort of sympathy for them, because whatever they do, it will rain down on them.
I have two questions for you.
Sure.
We were watching a show last night that was an alternate history where the Equal Rights Amendment passed. And being a daughter of that age, I remember that the 14th Amendment was used by a lot of states to say that the Equal Rights Amendment wasn't necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I've grown up in an age where at my ripe old 70, women still are not earning money on equal pay for equal work. And I'm wondering how that still happens with the 14th Amendment in place, which obviously did not protect women.
First of all, you have to remember that, actually, women do get equal pay for equal work if it's government work. The 14th Amendment only restrains the government.
It doesn't
keep the pizza parlor in northern Indiana from discriminating against gay people, and it doesn't keep the local constabulatory, whatever, coffee house from deciding to pay women less. I mean, now there are civil rights laws that theoretically at least outlaw that behavior, but then you have to enforce them by going to court. But, you know, not only do we have various state laws that vary all over the country, but we also have big differences between the laws that restrain what government can do and the laws that restrain what private enterprise can do, or private anything. So,
the second part is living in Indiana, which is one of the most gerrymandered states in the United States. How is it that with the 14th Amendment in place, gerrymandering is still allowed to exist?
I have made that argument. I have made that argument a lot. I mean, if you really want to see me, you know, like the smoke come out of my ears, we have a Supreme Court that dismissed the last effort to outlaw gerrymandering to find that the process of political control of redistricting violates not only equal protection, but the one person, one vote decisions. I mean, the person that I know best in Indiana who has been making that argument and had high hopes for the court was Ted Boehm, who was on our Indiana Supreme Court. And I mean, he and I were minority members of a study committee that our horrible Indiana legislature put together a couple of years ago to look at gerrymandering, where the majority of that group, after hearing massive evidence to the contrary, said, well, we're fine, we don't do it. The thing that really, really makes Indiana's legislature able to be as terrible as our legislature is gerrymandering. And what makes it so difficult for Indiana voters to do anything about it is we also don't have a referendum or initiative possibility. So in other states, people have been able to gather, you know, I know I'm not making this a coherent argument, but when that study committee met, hundreds of citizens from around the state came to every open meeting, and they were uniformly against gerrymandering. Did our legislative overlords do anything about that? Hell no. Excuse me. Heaven no.
We're going to hell or heaven, either way.
Whichever. It is the worst aspect of Indiana politics. And I don't know what we do about it. I mean, we have been effectively, gerrymandering, as most of you know, allows the legislators to choose their voters rather than allowing the voters to choose their legislators. And so long as that is the case, we are, I wonder, is screwed okay? And anyway.
Yeah, screwed is fine.
We're in bad shape. I'm sorry, sets me off.
I'm going to be that person. I have a comment about that. So I just moved from Virginia, where we did have a referendum that, you know, wasn't perfect, but it did, you know, do something about gerrymandering that it brought in third parties and not just party members. So it's interesting to learn that my new state does not have that. But I also wanted to ask, I'm sure you've seen What the Constitution Means to Me, either the play or the...
I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah. I believe, was the 14th Amendment part of that penumbra that she talks about?
I don't know, because I heard about that, but I never got there. So I don't know. But
there's a recording
Was she talking about the right to privacy and the penumbra? The 14th Amendment is not really part of the penumbra.
Okay.
But let me explain. Penumbra is almost as horrible a word as incorporation. It was an unfortunate term. What it really meant was that when you look at the Bill of Rights and you read it really as an organic whole, what it is doing is protecting individual autonomy, your right to govern yourself, your right to think what you want to think, have political views that you want to have religious views that you want to have, your right to go places without having to get the government to agree to it. I mean, but the entire Bill of Rights, the first eight that focus on our individual liberties, create a presumption that individuals have a right to self-govern. And that is what the right to privacy in the Constitution is. When people say privacy, I think too many Americans think, well, somebody's looking through my window while I'm getting undressed or something, or looking through my office files. That's not what privacy means in the constitutional sense. Constitutionally, privacy means your right to personal autonomy. your right to bodily control, which, of course, our current, I won't go there. But that is really, the term penumbra refers to that organic reading of the Bill of Rights. And as I say, it's an unfortunate term because people who don't really believe in liberty or rights will say, well, what's a penumbra? You know, I mean, I've heard that. But that is the actual background of that decision. Excuse me.
Hi. I wanted to comment again on the voting thing. I came from Ohio, and I was very active in the that referendum to get it on the ballot.
Right.
And just before voting actually took place, they bombarded the airwaves with all kinds of scary things about it so that people wouldn't vote for it. And so it didn't pass. And now I hadn't been keeping track as to whether it eventually passed or...
It did.
It did.
It did.
Yeah, I thought it did.
I watched those things.
Yeah, so, but I just wanted to say, I worked really hard. I was out with my feet canvassing, and then it didn't pass the first time. Yeah.
I know. I think one of the worst parts of being an American right now is that so many of us feel so powerless. I mean, and in Indiana, we are. But... Yeah, we can only do what we can do.
I'm curious, what would be the process in Indiana to get to getting the referendum, the right to have a referendum?
There isn't one. I mean, there have been lawsuits that have gone nowhere. We don't have a referendum or an initiative, so we can't... mount that sort of a the only hope I have is that in this supermajority state, as you all know, most of Indiana's legislators represent very rural districts, and of course when the gerrymandering occurred, as Common Cause will explain, the districts were drawn in a way that took urban areas and married them to larger rural areas so that the people who are elected really are more responsive to the rural voters in their districts than, I mean, it was very clever. The good news, it's not really good news civically, but it is what it is. Those rural districts in Indiana are emptying out. And I think the last time I was here, you guys were talking about the fact that Danville's growing and many more people are coming. We are urbanizing the state very slowly, but it is happening. The last time that redistricting occurred, they did not add to their supermajority because there were fewer people. And in fact, what happened, according to a friend of mine who is the head of political science at IU Indianapolis, he said that the redistricting had to take account of the fact that each of the districts that are still considered safe nevertheless have a much smaller margin than they did the 10 years before. So, you know, there will be demographic shifts that may ultimately, not in my lifetime, perhaps in some of the younger people's lifetime, may actually bring Indiana into like the 20th century. 21st is asking a lot, but, you know.
I tend to be the epitome of the eternal optimist, but I look at the stuff that's going on now, and especially if Trump's criminally convicted, maybe twice before the election, and especially with what you're talking about
I don't think the MAGA people care.
We might at least be able to make it not a supermajority anymore in Indiana. That's my hope and prayer. Any more questions? Seems like I had another one. I don't remember what it was. Julian, nothing? That's most unusual. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you guys for keeping me coming back. I like this book.
Okay, so I think we're ready for another hymn. This is one is
149.
Oh, there it is. 149.
Yes.
Lift every voice and sing.
Lift every stand. All right, you sopranos.
Oh, no. No, no. Oh,
this is your chance to shine.
I have a fix for the rest of you. You can sing it in a lower register for the first part, and then you can move to the higher register for the low part that I can't hit, and then you can move back to the soprano register for the rest of it. So,
as long as it doesn't throw the guitar player, you can do whatever you want.
Lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Loud rejoicing noise, high as the listening skies, let it resound, loud as the march on till victory is won. Slowly the road we trod, hither the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yet with a steady beat, have not a to the place for which our Father sighed. We have come over a way that the tear has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered. Out of the gloomy past, till now we stand at last, where the white gleam of our bright stars cast. God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who hast brought us thus far on the way, thou who hast by thy might led us into light, keep us forever in the path we pray. Lest our feet stray from the places of God where we met thee. Lest our hearts drunk with the wine of the world we forget thee. Shadow beneath thy
true to our God, true to our name.
That was a new hymn for me. Woo. So I will extinguish our chalice, and we have a short closing reading. The Constitution is worth saving. The rule of law is worth saving. Democracy is worth saving. But these things can and will be lost if everyone waits around for someone else. Timothy Snyder. Thank you all very much. Please join us for coffee and conversation downstairs. And thank you for being here today. And I love you all.
Do you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums,